I've lived in a lot of places, and I always thought I'd know when I found the one that felt like home. And then I moved to Wisconsin. I didn't actually mean to stay. I was from East Coast cities, and suddenly here I was in this state with more cows than people. I mean, grown men and women here wear cheese heads to football games. And when it gets really cold, people go out on frozen lakes and they drill holes in the ice and then they sit there and fish. So I didn't move here and just fall in love with this place. But over time, it did become my home. I don't know if I took root in it or it took root in me, but yeah, I'm a Packer fan. I know a whole lot about cheese. In the winter, I walk out on frozen lakes and I look at the stars. So anyone who's ever moved to a new place knows what this is like. It takes time and emotional investment to make a place feel like your home. I'm Anne Strange-Champs, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're going to talk about how someone finds home, makes home, in an unfamiliar place. Because we're living through a period of mass human migration. Thousands of people all over the planet are on the move, not always by choice. For instance, take Mariella Shaker. She went from a city of 2 million in Syria to a small town in rural Illinois of less than 10,000. Here's how she found home.
I remember going to the music institute and not knowing if I will make it back home because of the mortars and the horror we were experiencing. To me, as I was 23, I had a great ambition to be able to find my way out of Syria. I didn't want to be killed in such a way. I wanted to have a future. I wanted to come here to be able to help others who are in need in Syria. My name is Mariella Shaker. I'm a violinist from Aleppo, Syria. When I was junior, I went to London for an audition for the Master of Music program, and I was accepted. But sadly, the war prevented me from doing so, so I kept searching for another opportunities. After 7 months of truly hard work, I was able to find about Monmouth College and what they are doing for Syrian students to find a warm home there. I was very excited about the idea. I sent them my violin recitals, and they were very eager to help me. They granted me a full tuition scholarship, and I went there as a junior for a second bachelor degree in music performance. When I was about to leave Syria, I needed to catch up my flight from Beirut to the US. All the roads from and to Aleppo were closed. So we were advised to go to a certain area in Aleppo where there are a lot of buses, but they are not affiliated with any company, and it's gonna be on your own risk. We went very early, about 7 a.m. We were the first people to go on that route, and it's shocking to me to see along the way while we were leaving Aleppo, you know, everything is destroyed, going back to nothing. So it was just hard. It was very dangerous road, over than 50 checkpoints along the way. They thought the violin is a gun. I had to always open it and prove it's not. The bus driver got lost and we were very scared. A couple of times I cried on that way. First, because I know it's probably the last goodbye with my mom who accompanied me on the way. And second, because I did not know if I will make it to Beirut. It was very scary. We were not allowed even to take water with us. When I arrived to Beirut, it was a relief. It's kind of moving from hell to heaven. That moment I realized, oh wow, we made it. I feel safe. It was the first step to achieve my dream to come to the US. And I was so glad to be able to be there. But the same time, I was very, very sad. I was compelled to say goodbye to my mom. The moment we were at the airport in Beirut, it was a very sad moment. And my mom told me that she believes in me so much and I will be able to be successful there. It's kind of hard to go to a place where you don't know anyone there. It's kind of an adventure. I found life in Monmouth College is really great. It's a wonderful place to start. They arrange transportation from the airport or train station, and they welcomed us with joy. And it was one of the most amazing experiences in my life. So we were having the orientation and all of that, but all what I wanted to see is a music building. I was asking, I don't want to have fun. I don't want to go to the orientation. Can you just take me to the music building? To me, it was a very safe place. It was very calm, and I felt very welcome, especially in a place like Monmouth. The U.S. has opened a lot of wonderful doors for my career, and they saved my life, and I'm truly grateful for this experience. I lost my home in Syria, but I found a new one in the U.S. I really hope that the situation in Syria will soon be better and we will have peace again. Just about 2 days ago, my family was survived mortars falling. I was talking with them on the phone. When it hit our place, the line was cut off, and I could not connect with them for 2 hours after that. Sometimes I just go on Facebook, I scroll down. I just fear that I will hear any bad news about them. It's just sad to be living here, but your heart is still there. Recently, I performed for International Rescue Committee, and I performed at the United Nations later on, the Kennedy Center, Aspen Ideas Festival. My goal is to be able to continue to represent my country and be able to always make my parents, my city, my country be proud of me and be able to continue to represent the Syrian people in the U.S. and in the world and be able to be a peace ambassador trying to carry a beautiful message through each performance.
Mariella Shaker is a Syrian violinist. She lives in Illinois. That feeling of home, feeling safe and secure, it's so vital, so important to our well-being. I know every time I go off on a work trip, I'm basically counting the minutes until I can get home and recharge. Neuroanthropologist John Allen believes that there is a deeper significance to that pull back home. He says it's one of the most important inventions in our evolution, one that marked our shift from nest-building apes to humans. Steve Paulson caught up with him to find out why.
John, you've written a natural history of the home. Do you think we have not fully appreciated how important home is to our lives?
Yeah, I don't think we really have. I mean, it's one of those universal things. And some of the universal things are intensely studied, like language and, other aspects of human behavior. But I think home is sort of taken for granted. And we haven't really appreciated how central that is, both as a biological unit and as a cultural unit for everybody.
And yet culturally, I would think ideas of what makes a home are so different. I mean, it's clear that it's more than just a house. A house does not necessarily make a home. But, some people might want that McMansion, and other people, other cultures, let's say Australian nomads, would have an entirely different idea of what makes a home.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of get at the idea that you build home from the inside out. And so home could be literally the absence of a structure. It could be the landscape you live in. But that feeling is, I think, shared. And so it's also defined by who you share a home with and what your as we anthropologists might say, a kin group is. But those also vary in composition. So really, it's why I try to look at it from this sort of basic cognitive perspective.
So what do you think are the essential qualities that makes someplace a home?
I think it is other people, and usually those other people would be related to you, but not necessarily. And so those people define to some extent that you interact with, whose lives are synchronized with your lives. That, I think, really reinforces a home feeling. It's also the place where you sleep and recover from whatever you define as the outside world.
You're talking about home as refuge, right? I mean, it's sort of it's the thing that's sort of not the outside world. It's the familiar.
Exactly.
It's almost an extension of yourself.
It is, and you define that world. It's the part of the environment that at least you feel like you define. Just because you have a little bit around you and you're familiar with it doesn't really protect you from huge predators or tornadoes or any of the other thousands of things in the world that are out to get you. But by defining it that way, by creating this space, you kind of trick your body into this feeling of security and safety. We're really quite unique in that regard. So it does seem like something new that came at least from our branch of the evolutionary tree.
It sounds like you're making the argument that home is partly what makes us human. And this was something pivotal that happened in our evolutionary history.
Yeah, partly is right. I'm not saying it's everything, but I certainly think it's part of the package. Because if we look at great apes, let's say orangutans and chimpanzees, who are our closest relatives, and then gorillas, you know, one thing they do that's sort of unique to them is they make a little bed every night out of leaves or grasses or whatever, or up in the tree, and they sleep there in their bed. But they never have that bed in the same place twice. They're always moving within a home range, as we use the word there, but over an area. So they don't ever hunker down and stay in a place. So for some reason in our evolutionary past, well, after we split for them, we started to hunker down in a place, at least for an extended period of time relative to our relatives.
But there are other animal species that do have one place. I mean, there are the beehives, dens, bird nests, prairie dog homes, towns, all that.
Exactly. And I think those are what would be convergent evolution. And there are benefits to exploiting and knowing a territory and space. But it's interesting that at least in our way of doing things, which meaning primate way of doing things, we were the only ones who really embraced that.
So take us back into this evolutionary history. What do you think changed? And when do you think this happened when our ancient ancestors started to develop this new sense of home? I guess what you're saying is staying put.
An archaeologist named Glenn Isaac many years ago suggested what he called a home-based model. And this would have come about 3 million years after we split, when he starts seeing cooperative hunting, stone tool use, and other sort of behaviors that at least start to hint at a human way of doing things as opposed to an ape way of doing things. And so he argued that for a lot of the same reasons that why home is important now, it's a place where people can pool resources, where children can be raised collectively. It's one interesting thing, at least to anthropologists, is that when an ape has a child, and it's a female who only takes care of the one child, even if she's in a group, she has one at a time. One of the advantages, if you want to look at it that way, that our ancestors had is they started to be able to handle more than one baby at a time, more than one dependent kid. And that's probably much more efficient in a home setting. That is, you can trade off care between the mother and the father, between relatives, and, you know, food and collective raising of kids is more efficient in if you know where the kids are, in a way.
There are so many interesting questions that this raises. I mean, one is whether those cultures that stopped being nomadic, that settled down in a physical space, I mean, established communities that they were not moving around, did something change psychologically? Did it sort of, I don't know, was there a whole different mindset then?
I think there are different mindsets that go along with how you live, yes. The nomadic people, they keep redefining their homes in different places. I have a friend who does a lot of backpacking and hiking, and he says how, you know, he's got a kit, and he goes camping, and he feels like when he's taken all his stuff, his coffee, you know, mug, his plate, and he builds a little fire, he feels at home again. And so in a sense, nomadic peoples do the same thing, and it is different when you're always surrounded by your stuff. But I do actually think that feeling is probably very common. And then what's changing is this external world of how much you where you start defining not everybody in your group as being part of your home or are part of your family, but where you start breaking down larger groups into smaller, more self-contained units, and that leads ultimately to us, where we think of the nuclear family as a natural thing, as the normal way people are, which is very odd.
So let's bring the story to the present then. What does all of this evolutionary history tell us about what home means today?
I think the main thing, again, about at home is the whole idea of security and a sense of safety from the world surrounding us. And I think that when you mix that up with an economic system where houses and dwellings are really important economic investments, not just for protection and shelter, but as an investment, then you start to mix up the safety you feel with home and the security with a speculative investment. And I think it can be there, as economists would say, as a confidence amplifier potentially for people who are living in their homes and using them as investment vehicles.
Well, it seems like there's something deeper as well. I mean, if you were suggesting that having a home is part of what it means to be human, then what does that say?
Yes.
If we don't have a home or a house, I mean, is it sort of a fundamental human right to have a house?
In Scotland, it is. In the UN Charter, is considered to be that, but only Scotland is a nation state actually codified that.
What does that mean? That Scotland
that they have
has
in
a legal
their
right
and they have a legal a right to shelter and home is part of their constitution or whatever their structure. They've in the last few years have put that in, but it does. The flip side of not having a home is being homeless, obviously, and that. Talking to homeless people or people who've been homeless, their sense of marginalization, of not belonging, of not only not having a place to live, but not having an identity anymore. Just this was a sort of side thing I found in doing research for this. You know, there are a lot of studies, brain studies of, you know, what bits of your brain light up when you're looking at something that's disgusting or stigmatized or whatever. And even in these studies that aren't even looking at homelessness, they would use a picture of a homeless person as their sort of prompt to elicit a disgusted reaction. And it shows how fundamental that view is, at least in our society.
Yeah. I'm curious whether any of this that we've been talking about has hit home for you personally, emotionally.
I've lived a lot of different places. I've lived overseas. And every time I've moved, you know, there's a time of adjustment and a time where you feel like, oh, this is new, this is strange, this is hard to live here. And then, you know, one day it's not. One day it becomes home. And what I find looking at that sort of experience and how I felt is I was totally unaware of it happening, that I can't put my finger on the day a strange place became home. And yet it happened over and over again in my life. So it shows our resiliency there, which gets back to the hallmark of really what it is to be human, is to be flexible, to be able to eat all sorts of different things, to be able to live under different situations, and to be able to adapt because we aren't tied like a bee or a wasp to a certain genetic program that we can deal with these things. And the tools that we have are really, you know, that are biological at a real basic level are also flexible. And so they let us do things and adjust.
That's neuroanthropologist John Allen. He's the author of Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Steve Paulson talked with him. And coming up, journalist Sebastian Younger has a new theory about why some veterans have a hard time coming home.
They were exposed to something very healthy out there. They were living a close communal existence with 30, 40 people that they loved and were connected to and totally dependent on for their survival. That's our evolutionary past. And so soldiers, ironically, they feel literally more in danger in a quiet, leafy suburb in America if they're alone than they feel in Afghanistan in their platoon.
It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about home in this hour. And coming home, that phrase, just think about it, coming home, it's supposed to be easy, right? Coming home is a relief, but it's not always. For instance, take veterans. Between 11 and 20% of veterans returning from Iraq or Afghanistan experience some form of PTSD. For them, coming home is both a relief and a struggle. War reporter Sebastian Younger knows what that's like, and he has an unusual new theory about why. In a new book called Tribe, he argues that it's not combat that's the problem. Instead, it's because there's something missing from our culture, the sense of being part of a tribe.
When I was young, I had an uncle figure named Ellis who was half Lakota Sioux and half Apache. And I remember when I was around 20, he said to me, you know, it was funny, all throughout the history of the United States, the white people were always running off to join the Indians, but the Indians never ran off to join the white people. And that always sort of stuck in my mind. I liked the idea of it. And then many years later, I'd spent a year off and on with a platoon in combat in eastern Afghanistan. It was a very rough place, 20-man position up on this ridge, a lot of combat. There's no internet. There was no even electricity for a while. It was really rough out there. And after it was all over, when the guys got back to Vicenza, Italy, where they're based, a lot of them said, you know, we don't want to go back to America. We'd rather, if we had the choice, we'd go back out to that outpost. And I remembered my Uncle Ellis, and I just thought, wow, what is it about modern society that's so unappealing on a human level? And so then it finally occurred to me, maybe the high rates of PTSD that we're seeing aren't a function of combat trauma. I mean, we're a species that's clearly wired to survive trauma, or we wouldn't be here. But maybe they're a function of trauma plus returning to an alienated individualistic society. Maybe that's what the human psyche really can't handle.
You spent years yourself, as you said, as a war reporter in some really difficult combat zones. You reported from Afghanistan, also from Bosnia. I mean, what has your own personal experience of this been, of coming home to America from a war zone?
Well, there's two components to it. I mean, if you go to a war zone, you're going to be traumatized. And I've come home with what I later realized was pretty severe PTSD. I mean, my experiences mostly happened before 9/11. So the term PTSD wasn't available to me to understand what I was experiencing. I just thought I was going crazy. And I had no, you know, I kept having panic attacks. And I had no reason to connect it to the combat that I'd been in. And so, you know, after some weeks or months, those panic attacks went away. But the other component of coming home is precisely what I was talking about before. If you travel in the developing world, war zone or not, you're in a close communal society. So Peace Corps volunteers, likewise, when they come back to America, about 25% of them sink into a real depression when they come home, which is just about exactly the estimated rate of PTSD in American soldiers, even though only around 10% of the U.S. military is engaged in combat. But 25% have significant psychological troubles when they come home. It's exactly like the Peace Corps, and it's exactly like my own struggles when I come home. It just feels like a sort of antiseptic, commodified society where people are just alienated from each other. I mean, this is the first time in history that people have been wealthy enough to have their own apartment, to sleep by themselves in their own room. I mean, that's unheard of in human society. Until recently. And as much as that is a liberty from the pressures of the group, there's also a significant and dangerous isolation there that really affects people.
You know, it's funny, you're describing us that way, and yet I would have said, I don't think I can go a day without seeing the word community someplace. I mean, you live in New England, this is fall. There are community harvest dinners in just about every rural area in New England. In my small city, there's constant talk about community justice forums or community charity drives. What is it that we're missing?
Well, you can't just stick the word on there and have it work some magic, right? Really, community in the anthropological sense, in the evolutionary sense, are the group of people clustered around you when you wake up in the morning. What you mean by community, if what you mean by that is the people are literally physically around you, that you depend on them for the food that you get, for the safety that you have, then you live in a real community. One of the things you see is even in modern society, when you introduce a crisis into modern society, like the Blitz in London or an earthquake or even 9/11 in New York, this communal feeling immediately happens. It's something that society does spontaneously in order to survive and defend itself. And as a result, you know, even a blizzard or a blackout, as a result, people look back with real fondness on times that should have been very frightening and hard. But people remember them very fondly precisely because, you know, the whole floor of your building is sort of clustered around one candle, you know, trying to waiting out the blackout or whatever it is. And that feels good because it reproduces, again, our evolutionary past, what we're wired for.
You're reminding me that my mother-in-law is saying, she was in her 80s, after 9/11, the national mood reminded her most strongly of what it was like to be living here during World War II.
Yes, in America, after the Depression, during the Depression, World War II, I mean, these kind of crises bring about, even at the national level, a sense of unity. In New York City, I live in New York, the suicide rate went down in New York after 9/11. The murder rate, the violent crime rate went down. The great sociologist Emil Durkheim realized in the late 1800s that countries that were at war experienced a drop in their suicide rate, what are called antisocial behaviors, because people realize that their community needs them. I mean, one of the tragedies of modern society, along with all of its benefits, is that we're wealthy enough to have the idea that our community actually does not need our direct involvement. Our society does not need our direct involvement. We are effectively unnecessary for the survival of others. And that's really, really demoralizing. They've even found with older people that if they feel necessary to those around them, they will live longer. Hmm. And older people that feel unnecessary tend to die more quickly. So that's clearly something that is necessary for not only our mental health, but even in some ways our physical health.
Yeah, this is a story you tell that really stuck with me, and I wanted to ask you to tell us about this person. She's a Bosnian journalist named Nizara Amatasevic. Tell us about her, because it's such an illuminating story.
The first war that I was in was Bosnia in 1993. And as I'm sure we all remember, a modern army, the Bosnian Serb army, surrounded a modern city, Sarajevo, and basically used the civilian population for target practice for 3 or 4 years. But they survived. They made it. They lived in their basements. They acted collectively. They had militia groups that defend their neighborhoods, and they made it. So I was there during those terrible times, and I didn't have a chance to go back to Sarajevo until a year and a half ago. But I met this journalist, Nizara, who was 17 when the war broke out, and she didn't give much thought to it. She had a boyfriend. She had friends. This is sort of the adult's problem, until a Serb tank round slammed into her parents' apartment, and a shrapnel fragment almost took one of her legs off. Her father rushed her to the hospital in his arms through the shelling at night, and instead of amputating her leg, her father convinced the doctor to try to save her leg, and he did through a long surgical procedure that she had to endure without anesthesia because there was none in the city.
God.
And so when I saw her, she said to me when we met, she lowered her voice and she said, you know, it's weird. The war was so terrible and thank God it's over, but we all miss it. The civilians all miss the war. And what she said was that she said basically we acted better then. We were better people then. We cared for each other. We were selfless. We looked out for each other. Now we just take care of our own individual lives and we're smaller people. And she said there's even graffiti in Bosnia that said things were better when they were bad, referring to the war.
So the question is it possible to restore some of that kind of joy or goodness of those kind of tribal relationships without war?
Basically, you're asking how can we have it all? Like how can we live in a safe, comfortable, modern society with all the amazing blessings and benefits that come with that, and regain this sort of sense of community that throughout human history has been created by danger and by hardship. Can we have it all? Honestly, not quite. I don't think we can. But I think there's a lot we can do to foster more of a sense of community at the neighborhood level and all the way on up to the national level. I think we can, there are deliberate choices we can make as a society without burning down the suburbs and going back to living in lean-tos. I mean, obviously, that's not a possibility.
Well, I'm thinking that one example you brought up in the book, near the beginning, I think you were thinking about the recession, and you pointed out that as many people committed suicide after the recession, you know, after presumably losing their jobs or whatever, as were injured during some of our wars, And yet, of course, there was very little fallout for the people who crashed the economy, which is an example of undercutting community.
Yeah, I mean, one of the characteristics of an organic tribal society is that it is adamant about punishing anything, anyone who threatens its safety and its welfare. That may be an enemy across the river, or it could be people in their own society that are acting in dangerous, unnoble ways. And so one of the things that's punished very, very quickly is a betrayal of the group. Stealing food, someone bullying other people into giving them more resources. So if you look at America, in 2008, a relatively small number of mostly men in the financial industry gambled with the welfare of this nation and hurt us tremendously. I mean, really put us in danger. They cost us, the recession cost us around $14 trillion. And if I'm remembering my math correctly, that's around $45,000 per person. So the people that did this to us, without exception, have not been punished. They haven't really even been sanctioned socially in very harsh ways. That's new, right? I mean, most societies in human history would take those people out and hang them. And I'm not advocating that. But when you ignore something that's so obviously bad for everybody, you're sending the message as a nation. You're sending the message. You know what? There isn't really any there. I mean, you say, okay, we call ourselves America, but you know what? America won't even look out for its own interests. It won't even protect itself from itself. And if that's the case, you, the citizen, really don't belong to anything. It's a fiction.
Well, it's interesting. It makes me think, what would we do as a culture if we were serious about defending us, the people of the United States, with the same vigor that we use to defend us against, you know, supposed outside attacks?
Well, I think we would need a real revision of our sort of legal and moral system, political system, really, where people who are very powerful, economically and politically powerful, if they damage this country, that they experience justice, legal justice. I mean, the punishments for stealing $100 are way harsher than for defrauding the country of 100 million. That's not right. But in addition, I think the use of contempt in political speech for political rivals is really corrosive to the American soul. It's a little bit like hearing your parents scream at each other when you're a kid. Like, wow, are mom and dad going to get divorced? Like, is this the end of this family? I think it's what it felt like to endure this ghastly election campaign of 2016. I mean, the kind of insinuations and mockery and derision and contempt that many candidates expressed for others and for voters was really grotesque. And I think it sends the message, again, like, there's no country here to defend. I mean, no one out at Restrepo, this outpost I was at, I mean, there were lots of tensions and dislikes, and there were guys who straight up hated each other, but no one had contempt for someone who might save their life tomorrow morning. You don't use contempt on someone who's inside the wire. And when you use contempt with a fellow American, a Mexican-American, or your political rival, or a Democrat or a Republican, when you use contempt, and both sides do it, you're basically saying, you know what, you're not really American. You're not inside the wire. You're other. And you shouldn't be in this country. And, when you accuse the president of deliberately trying to harm this country, you are undermining this democracy in ways that are far more dangerous than Al-Qaeda or ISIS ever could. It's a really, really corrosive thing to do. And I think it should be it's protected under free speech, of course, but I think the social sanction against using that kind of speech should be so high that politicians stop doing it.
Sebastian, thank you so much for talking today. This was just great.
It's my pleasure.
Sebastian Younger is the author of Tribe, On Homecoming and Belonging. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Thank you. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Jonathan Chait from New York Magazine, and the book I want to talk about is What Hath God Wrought by Daniel Walker Howe, which is part of the Oxford History of the United States of America and covers the period from 1815 to 1848, which is a fascinating book which has really changed the way I've thought about American history, even though, and in some ways because, it covers a time period that I didn't know very much about and receives probably less treatment in popular culture than a lot of other periods, but is really a crucial one. This was a time when America expanded massively at the expense of different kinds of people who were living on the periphery of white settled American life. And at the beginning of this period, it wasn't clear that American power would prevail over these lands in the way it ultimately did. But I think the thing that makes this book so fascinating to me is that it reframes the whole history of the intellectual debate in American life. And what Howe argues is that you had two really important ideas that were fighting with each other for supremacy. You had the Jacksonian idea, which is the one that prevailed in most of this time, which was the Democratic Party, which was then based in the South and was very, very suspicious of the central government and was in favor of slavery and resistant to any changes to the social order, including more humane treatment of Native Americans and more rights for women. And then you had the Whig tradition, which was based in New England and was based on a more active role for the federal government and more liberal social relations, less aggressive foreign policy. And I think if you really study that debate as it existed at the time, this gives you a template for the political arguments that we see today. And I think it's especially interesting because for a long period of time after the Civil War, things got very, very scrambled because the Democratic Party stayed the party of the South, and then the North had the Republican Party, which for a while was a very left-wing party at the beginning, but then stopped being a left-wing party and then became a right-wing party. And then the Democratic Party eventually brought in all the liberals, and then the liberals took it over. And so you had these parties that were scrambled for well over 100 years, and we couldn't see that where we've become now is the same place we were in the time that Howe was writing about it at the beginning of the 19th century, where you had this Yankee tradition against the Southern tradition, which is still the debate we have. So you can really see the divided, polarized red versus blue America emerging in a much clearer way 200 years ago. So that's the use to which I've really been putting this book.
Jonathan Chait recommends What Hath God Wrought? The Transformation of America, 1815 to 1848. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Chait on our website at ttbook.org.
I was researching my first historical novel, Fever 1793.
Writer Laurie Hulse Anderson.
And I came across a book that explored the slave owning of Benjamin Franklin, who had been my super big hero growing up. I just adored every aspect of Benjamin Franklin. And nobody told me he had held people in slavery for his entire adult life. We prefer, of course, to focus in on the fact that as in his 80s, he founded the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, so you think, oh, he's a good guy. But when I realized that this hero and this very significant founding father held people in slavery, at least nine of them we have primary source evidence for, it nauseated me. It was horrified me.
That was about 20 years ago. Laurie Hulse Anderson was at the very beginning of her career as a children's and young adult novelist, and she could not stop thinking about what it must have been like to be a slave in 1776, when the white colonists all around you were talking about liberty and justice, just not for you. So she started reading and researching. She wound up writing a trilogy called Seeds of America. It's about three young African-American slaves during the American Revolution. The first book was a finalist for the National Book Award, the second was a bestseller, and the third, called Ashes, is just out.
I would like to point out that the American Revolution lasted as long as the publication history of this series. So I have very, very patient fans, and I thank them for waiting for this book.
Laurie, how widespread was slavery around the time of the American Revolution?
In 1776, 20% of the population of New York City was held in slavery, and Philadelphia as well. You had slaves in Boston, Albany, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, what we call Maine.
20%. You're right. That's one in five. One in five people in New York was a slave.
And Philadelphia.
Wow.
Yes. Our country was founded on land that was taken away from the Indian nations and on the labor of unfree people.
So the terrible irony in this history, and the irony that is the bedrock of your three novels in this Seeds of America series, is that here during the Revolutionary War and the period leading up to it, here's the whole country talking about freedom and liberty and condoning slavery at the same time. And this is where your characters came from, right? You kept thinking about that and wondering what would it have been like to be a slave in New York or Philadelphia or Boston when everybody's talking about freedom and you're enslaved.
And they're not talking about you. They're not talking about people who look like you. That was the question that has driven me for 20 years. I did a lot of research trying to understand this, speaking to historians. And what really came to me one day, I was at the New York Historical Society. They had a magnificent exhibit about slavery in New York, and they published a book about it too. And I walked into the exhibit. They had a sculpture that was made out of thin wire, and it was a sculpture of a man and a woman who were trying to liberate themselves, trying to free themselves from slavery. But it was the brilliance of this piece of art is that if you moved a little bit sideways, you couldn't see it, because the wire was so thin. And then you move back, and there they were. And it was such a testimony to the ever-presence of people in slavery throughout the United States during the colonial time period, and then how so many people chose not to see them.
Yeah.
And as I stood, exactly, I stood there kind of rooted to the spot, and I heard the voice of Isabel, my main character, in my ear, and she said, "The best time to talk to ghosts is just before morning." And I pulled out my pencil, and I started to scribble away. I think I had been researching for about 2 years at that point, reading every narrative I could that came from former slaves trying to tell their own history, trying to understand as much as I could, what did that feel like.
How old is Isabel when we first meet her? She's about 13?
She's 12 years old.
12. Yeah.
12 years old, and she's in charge of her little sister Ruth, who's 5. Their parents have died. They've been sold to new people who they don't know, and they find themselves transported to New York City in the middle of the most dramatic summer ever. The Patriot Army is occupying the city, and then the British show up.
And then what happens?
She's enlisted in a spy ring. There were lots of spy rings operating in New York City at that time period. One of the inspirations for this character came from an apocryphal figure I haven't been able to find good primary sources about, but it's a young girl named Phoebe Francis, whose father ran Francis Tavern in New York City during that summer of 1776. And people said that Phoebe was one of the people who overheard the assassination plot against George Washington, which was a real thing, and she helped to save Washington. So I fold that into the story. Washington commanded that everybody on the island of Manhattan needed to attend the hanging of the man who was in charge of trying to assassinate him.
Mm. Isabel is her owners are loyalists.
Right.
Pro-British. Were there differences in how either the loyalists, the Tories, versus the Patriots treated slaves?
Well, and that difference changed over time when you have a war that lasts 8 years. Originally, the British, very early in the war, began to offer freedom to those slaves who could run and join them, first men of soldiering age and then all slaves. They didn't do that because they were nice. They did that because they wanted to disrupt the Patriot economy. When Isabel tries to do that, she's given back because is held in property of a loyalist family, and the British didn't want to upset their loyalist friends. The Patriots, of course, had no interest in freeing anyone, but what the Patriots did have was a cohort of African-American men, some free, some still held in slavery, others who liberated themselves from slavery, who heard that call of freedom and signed up. George Washington didn't want them in the beginning of the war in 1775 in Boston. But then he begins to accept black men and boys into his army, which is where Curzon starts to get involved.
And right, I was going to say, this is moving into your second.
Into the next
second
one, right.
Book, Forge.
Exactly.
This one's narrated by Curzon, who's heard all this talk about liberty and decided to join the Patriots. And the book follows him to Valley Forge. So how many African Americans fought in the Revolutionary War?
By the time they marched out of Valley Forge, about 10% of those men were men of color. By the time you get to Yorktown, the numbers aren't quite as hard, but I've seen some estimates as high as 20%. And remember, this was an integrated army. These were black and white soldiers fighting together for this cause. It was the last time our army was integrated until the Korean War in the 1950s.
I think I read somewhere that you actually have some ancestors who fought in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, a lot of my mom's folks come from New England. So most of those people fought for the Patriots. One branch of the family were loyalists and wound up being banished to Nova Scotia for a while before they made their way back to Massachusetts.
Did that make any of this feel more vivid? Or did you wind up, in terms of thinking about slavery, feel more complicit or implicated in any way, knowing that you'd had relatives back then?
I think it's more important as a white person in America to recognize the privilege that I'm living with every day. Not that I can't be responsible for the things done by people who lived before me, but I can and do take responsibility for what our country looks like today. And, you know, understanding, for example, that I didn't have to teach my teenage son not to walk down the street with his hood up and his hands in his hoodie. And understanding that, just coming to terms with that, I think, is where my responsibility lies in figuring out how to talk to friends, how to help people open up their eyes and their hearts a little bit more. That's way more important than whatever I feel about my ancestors.
So you've just come out with the third and final book in this trilogy, Ashes. And it's been, 8 years or something since the first one came out? So your fans have all been eagerly waiting to see what was going to happen with Isabel and Curzon. So give us a little synopsis. What's happening in Ashes?
Yeah, this is where everything wraps up. The end of the war, especially as fought in the South, was particularly ugly and bitter. That's where you really have the poor state of Virginia had the British run through it, trying to set fire to everything. South Carolina suffered deeply, North Carolina as well. People who were held in bondage, however, were able to take advantage of that chaos. One of the historians who vetted my manuscript has speculated there's a pretty good chance that more families, enslaved families, were able to liberate themselves, obtain their freedom because of the chaos of the American Revolution, than were able to free themselves through the Underground Railroad before the Civil War. So Isabel and Curzon and Ruth are caught up in that. It was a very frightening time for anybody of color, even soldiers who could prove that they were free people, because you had slave owners in Virginia so desperate to replace their workforce that they were grabbing people. It didn't matter what their status was. If they looked like they could be a slave, then they could be enslaved. While these people are trying to fight for the freedom of their country. So it's a perilous time.
I mean, do you think the way issues of slavery and freedom were dealt with or not dealt with during this period of history set the nation up for the Civil War, 100 years later?
Oh, completely. There was an opportunity when they were framing the Constitution to outlaw slavery throughout the entire nation. And as I understand it, the states of South Carolina and Georgia, whose economies were so dependent on enslaved labor, said, if you pass this, then we will leave the Confederation of American States. We will rejoin Great Britain. And so in order to preserve what was the fragile United States, our leaders, whom we love to admire so much, could not find the courage of their convictions to make all Americans free.
How does that history, knowing this, How does it affect how you think about racism in America today? I mean, you've done clearly an enormous amount of research.
It helps me understand how we got to where we are today. It's fascinating to discuss this with friends of mine who are white and to feel their resistance. Not because they're bad people. These are often very liberal, politically liberal, open-hearted people. But they don't know their history. They don't know how we got to where we are today. If they would let me teach a history course, I would start it in the protests after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And I would teach history backwards to show you how the institutional racial injustices of today and the lack of understanding of the lack of equalities in America today are directly tied to not only the founding of the United States, but the fact that we haven't had the courage to be honest about that founding. And while we can, and I certainly hold up people like George Washington with respect, and I'm a very patriotic American, I don't want to live in a country where the Declaration of Independence is written to a certain kind of person. It was written for all of us. Those powerful words are what bring people here to America from all over the globe to help us make what I believe is the most fascinating, diverse, strongest country ever in terms of its people. But we're not going to get there until we understand our history. Once we do that, then we can look at the present with open eyes and begin planning for a true United States in the future.
Laurie Halse Anderson. Seeds of America is a series of historical novels set in colonial America. The third and final volume is just out. It's called Ashes. And that's it for this hour, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you catch your podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour. With help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Until next time.